Our speaker today is Bob Inglis. He was elected to the U.S. Congress in 1992. He represented Greenville, Spartanburg, South Carolina from 1993 to 1998, and then again from 2004 through 2010, when he was defeated in the Republican primary, easily defeated. In 2011, he went full-time into promoting free enterprise action on climate change and launched the Energy and Enterprise Initiative at George Mason University. In 2014, that effort evolved to become RepublicN.org, a growing grassroots community of over 5,000 members educating the country about the free enterprise solutions to climate change. Bob is the organization's executive director. For his work on climate change, he received the 2015 John F. Kennedy Profile and Courage Award. He appears in the film Merchants of Doubt and in the Showtime series Years of Living Dangerously. He's given TED Talks in Jacksonville, Florida, and in Boston, and he's been interviewed on many, many national news programs for his work. He's been a resident fellow at Harvard's Institute of Politics, a visiting fellow at Duke's Nicholas School of the Environment, and a resident fellow at the University of Chicago's Institute for Politics. He grew up in the Lowcountry of South Carolina, graduated from Duke and from the University of Virginia Law School, and practiced commercial real estate law in Greenville, South Carolina, before and during his years in Congress. Bob and his family live on a small farm in Greenville County. Actually, he calls it a farmette. Now a personal note. I heard this guy being interviewed back in 2013 on NPR while driving. When I got home, I sat down and wrote him a love letter. I volunteered to work for him, etc. Well, he spurned my offer, but at least he did it graciously, saying maybe we'd meet again, sometime in Charlottesville. Well, it's finally happened. Bob, please tell us about how conservative economics and ethics principles can lead to effective climate change action. Please.
All right, thank you, that's better. Because the way you know a politician is lying is his lips are moving, and so you need to be close enough to see him. And so even recovering politicians, maybe. So thank you very much, Bob. It wasn't spurned, the love wasn't spurned. See, I'm here, and so I'm very happy to be here and very happy to be with you. Oh, but much wiser. Much wiser. So thank you for the opportunity to be here. I always will enjoy opportunities to come to Charlottesville. I went to law school here, as you heard just now, and so it's a place of many wonderful memories, particularly since my wife and I spent our honeymoon years over at Copley Hill, married student housing at UVA. And so that was... It's always fun to drive by 28-3 Copley Hill and think about how a friend told me that in law school you'll have more time and more money than you'll have in the rest of your life. And at the time I thought, ooh, that doesn't sound good because I don't feel like I have much time now and we surely didn't have much money. But in retrospect, it was $238 a month for rent at 28-3 Copley Hill. It included electricity and water. So all inclusive was $238. And my wife and I had not yet had our five children, and they had not yet had those things that seem expensive. First, it was diapers. I thought those were expensive until I met the orthodontist. And then after meeting the orthodontist, I met the bursar at five very fine universities. And so I think my friend turned out to be right, that I had more time and money in those years here in Charlottesville at 28-3 Copley Hill than I had the rest of my life. Now I've got debt. So great to be with you. And I want to, before I say much about what I'm going to say, I want to find out something about you. But and I want to help you to help me figure out what it means to be a conservative in these times, because I think the labels maybe always are somewhat misleading, but especially in our current day, they're terribly misleading and terribly confused. So tell me, if I say the word conservative, what adjacent words come to your mind? I mean, what are positions or statements or descriptors of what is conservatism? Just call it out. What's a word or an adjective or a social?
Old and white.
Traditionalist. What's that?
Traditionalist.
Traditionalist.
Fiscal.
Fiscal.
Practical and logical.
Practical and logical. I like you. What's your name? What's your name? Okay. Oh, really? Oh, I saw a Duke license tag in the parking lot.
Getting value for your money.
Getting value for your money. Okay. Yes, sir.
Stodgy.
Don't want
to support government and pay taxes.
Don't want to support government and pay taxes.
Conserving things like the earth.
Conserving things like the earth.
Gun rights.
Gun rights.
Strict interpretation of the Constitution.
Strict interpretation of the Constitution.
Rigid and inflexible.
Rigid and inflexible. I need to get you with my friend up here in the front row. Move over so he can sit with you. Just kidding. You got to rub off on him, all right? What else? Other issues, yeah.
Supposedly family values, but not truly.
Supposedly family values, but not truly. Okay. Yeah.
Libertarian is often associated, but not always.
Libertarian tendencies, maybe, for conservatives, yep. Yeah. Your parents come to mind, okay.
Generally opposed to climate change.
Generally opposed to climate change, okay.
Respect for the Constitution and the rule of law.
Respect for the Constitution and rule of law, okay. Yes, sir.
Pro-life.
What else? Yes, sir.
Christianity.
Oh, gee, that's dangerous for the faith. but it's probably true, right? But to couple it with a political movement is sort of dangerous. Interesting. Okay, very interesting, helpful. Any last submissions to what it means, what conservative conjures in your mind? Yes, ma'am. Smaller government, okay.
I was on one end thing, opposition to change.
Opposition to change, okay. Was it privileged?
Privileged,
okay.
Economically
privileged. All right, so that's very helpful, very interesting. I've got a little informal social survey I'm doing in my mind here. I did this with some groups yesterday, and this is another one, very helpful to... So let me ask you now, if I ask you, let's say, try to go beyond the current moment where things are quite confused and think of yourself as either, if I could sort of force you into a dichotomy of, generally speaking, would you be left of center or right of center? I'm interested in a show of hands. How many here would say that you're left of center? And how many would say you're right of center? Okay, so now...
The rest of them are in the center.
I should have asked about center. Anybody wants to declare themselves center? Okay, so... all right, and let me ask this another way, too, just sort of curious. I'm going to ask you to show your hands if you think that... Don't do it yet. I'm going to give you three options. We're going to see how many end up staying or with their hands up. I'm going to ask you if climate change is real, and then if it's human caused, and then if we can do something about it. And so,
can I ask when
we can do something about it? Yes, as in when we're going to act or when we're going to... Okay, yeah. Within the next couple or 3 years.
Can I ask for clarification?
Yeah.
You say human caused.
Mm-hmm.
Is it human influence is probably a better statement than human caused?
Okay. So human contribution. We'll say human contribution. How about that? Is that all right? Okay, so raise your hand if you think that climate change is real, and keep them up if you think it's human influenced, and that you think we can do something about it.
Can or will?
Can do something about it. Okay, now, and keep your hands up if you identified as right of center. Okay, I want to kiss each one of you. You are my new friends. You are the ones I'm looking for. The rest of you, no, whatever, go on to your business. But those that had their hands up, those at the last, that's who I'm after. Because you are the most important people on the planet for saving us from the effects of climate change. Because the reality is the left is going about as far as it can go. Like the line from Oklahoma. We got to find people on the right that are willing to act on climate change. And that's what my organization is all about, republicen.org. So let me, now that I've found out something about you, and that's been very helpful, let me tell you a little bit about myself and my own story about how I got to this and maybe what Bob heard on NPR that day. So I represented, as Bob told you, Greenville, Spartanburg, South Carolina in the U.S. Congress. It's a pretty conservative place. In fact, I think I can say here that it's probably the reddest district and the reddest state of the nation. There are some places where I pull that punch. Idaho, some places in Texas. I don't make that boast. But here in Charlottesville, Virginia, which is almost certainly a blueberry in a bowl of tomato soup in this congressional district, I think I can say that the 4th District of South Carolina is more conservative than this congressional district. So for my first 6 years in Congress, I said that climate change was nonsense. I didn't know anything about it except that Al Gore was for it. And if you represented the 4th District of South Carolina and you had the experience of going to Congress and trying to find out all kinds of things all at once, maybe you would have done the same thing, right? It's like this. I have a friend that used to represent New Haven, Connecticut in the U.S. Congress, and he said that being sent to Congress is like being sent to Yale to take every course they offer in the first year you're there. And so some courses you take pass-fail. And so I took climate change pass-fail. Al's for it, I'm against it, next course. Let's move along, you know. And so I admit that's pretty ignorant, but that's the way it was for 6 years. Then I was out of Congress doing commercial real estate law again in Greenville. Had the opportunity to run for Congress yet again in 2004. And in that race, my son came to me. He just turned 18, so he was voting for the first time. And he said to me, Dad, I'll vote for you, but you're going to clean up your act on the environment. It was the first of a three-step metamorphosis for me. And by the way, my son was clearly going to vote for me no matter what, right? I mean, it was not in his economic interest to vote against me. I mean, if we had lost by one vote, and that happens, you know, it would have been bad for him, because actually he was off at that college in New Haven, Connecticut, and it would have been real bad for him, right? And so so he's going to vote for me no matter what. What he's really saying was, Dad, I love you, and you can be better than you were before. So let's see this as Inglis 2.0, the new and improved version, making the last one Inglis 1.0. And so his four sisters agreed, his mother agreed, These people can change the locks on the doors. It's a very important constituency to respond to. I mean, that is a very important constituency. And so so I got on the science committee, and the second step of this metamorphosis was going to Antarctica and seeing the evidence there in the ice core drillings. And the evidence is really sort of basic, to tell you the truth. You know, we make climate science quite complex and complicated. It's actually not very complicated, the basics of it. The modeling of it is tremendously complicated. And I'll get to briefly mention that here. But the basics are this, and this is what I learned in Antarctica, is that And the learning comes, by the way, from the ice core drillings. But the South Pole, for example, in Antarctica, a fun fact to know and tell that you learned here today at the center, is a desert. It gets a quarter of an inch of precipitation a year. At the South Pole, it's 10,000 feet above sea level. It's 5,000 feet of dirt and then 5,000 feet of ice. And in the 5,000 feet of ice, since it gets such a slow pileup of precipitation, there's an amazing record of the Earth's atmosphere. And so the scientists simply drill into the ice, pull up the ice cores, put them in coolers, and fly them to Ohio State and put them in the freezer at the Byrd Polar Research Center. And then they study the ice cores, and what it shows is this long period of stability in CO2 levels, followed by an uptick coinciding with the Industrial Revolution. And, you know, I'm not a scientist. By the way, that was the line from people in my party for a while, I'm not a scientist. The polling data on that turned out not to be too good, because it's sort of like saying, I'm not a truck driver, I have no position on highway funding. I'm not a doctor, I have no position on health care. No, the idea going to Congress is, no, you're not a scientist, but how about find out something about it and figure out what we could do? And so I'm not a scientist, but it's sort of basic what I learned there, right? Is that if I'm that correlation, which does not indicate causation, of course, but this correlation between this rise in CO2 and the coming of the Industrial Revolution is sort of understandable, even to a non-scientist. This winter, I was burning trees in my fireplace, and as you heard Bob said, we live on a little farm. If I'm chopping trees that die in my woods and putting them in my fireplace and burning them, I'm just accelerating by maybe a decade or so the reintroduction of that carbon into the atmosphere is CO2. I'm just accelerating a little bit. No big deal. But if I go deep in the earth and pull up trees long gone and under time and temperature and pressure have been turned into fossil fuels, coal, natural gas, petroleum, bring them to the surface and burn them, I'm changing the chemistry of the air. Now, if you're thinking of objecting, let me just say, don't object here yet, because there's nobody that objects to that. That's a chemical equation, and it's got an equal sign at the end of it. It's got to be the same on both sides of the equal sign. And so it's just a fact that if you burn fossil fuels, you change the chemistry of the air. And again, nobody disputes that. The physics of light, which have been known since the 1800s, are that light enters through our atmosphere, striking the Earth, creating heat. You know, if you go out there to my white rental car, it's cooler than the black one next to it. And so all of the heat that's created by the striking of the Earth doesn't all go back into space. Does off of my white car, but not off the black one next to me and not off the black asphalt. Well, thank goodness it doesn't all go back into space. If it did, the Earth would be uninhabitable, because it'd be hot in the day and cold at night, a little bit moon-like. And so thank goodness for the greenhouse gases. But if you add to them, it follows that what you get is warming. And that's what we see in the correlation that is strongest between CO2 levels and temperature. And if you go on our website, there's a Bloomberg infograph that's really fascinating. They show all the possibilities, all the things you hear about. Maybe it's volcanoes. Maybe it's something else. And what they show you in this pretty cool graphic is they show you the temperature record, and then they compare it to all of those possible things. And the only one that matches nearly perfectly is CO2 levels. The correlation is really strong for CO2. Not so strong for volcanoes, etc. Sunspots, definitely not, because the sun has actually been in a cooling period, not in an explosive period. And so this is all what we know from wonderful science, right? And so nobody, by the way, nobody disputes that yet, because again, those physics have been known a long time. But what is in dispute is the modeling, and it is hard, because basically what we're asking the climate scientists to do is model the climate systems of the whole Earth. Well, that's a pretty big job. You know, we had people using those same models to try to figure out where Hurricane Irma was going to strike the United States. It was coming at Miami as a Category 5 storm. And in the last 24 hours, it veered 45 miles west and hit Naples instead of Miami. So that's a storm with our eyes on it. We know the storm is there. We are tracking it using the same kind of modeling techniques that the climate scientists are using. And we were off by 45 miles in a 24-hour period. So if you want to pick apart climate science, you can in the models, because the models make assumptions and they make projections that are really subject to some uncertainty because of the time frame and because of all those assumptions that are made. But in the main, what we know is a storm is coming, whether it's coming to here in Charlottesville or to my house in Travelers Rest, South Carolina. Well, that's harder to tell. It's really hard to tell that. And so, but it's clear a storm's coming. And that's the point about, that's what I learned in Antarctica. So that's a second step of the metamorphosis for me. By the way, I'd add something there that's a little bit strange. There was a scientist in that trip that became particularly credible to me. He's a biologist at the University of Southern California. And he told me that he needed to go call his mother from Antarctica. Well, I had an aging and ailing mother at the time, and I identified with him, and therefore I could hear his science better. And that's odd, isn't it? On the other hand, maybe it isn't. Because as human beings, what we need to know is that you are sort of like me, and that maybe you like me. Then I can hear what you got to say. If you tell me that you're not like me or that you don't like me, I don't want to hear much more that you've got to say, right? And so this wonderful scientist, Donald Manahan, also had the benefit of being a master teacher. So he would hear John McCain's question, who was actually on a similar trip, and we overlapped there. And Senator McCain would ask a question sort of at the postdoc level, and Donald Manahan would go there. And then my question would come from the GED level, and Donald Manahan would go down there without condescension and answer the question. And what I've found in being on science committee and just in life is that if somebody really knows their stuff, they can do that. They can modulate from postdoc to GED and go anywhere in the range. But if you don't quite know your stuff, you got to stick just in the bandwidth that you know. And if the question comes from any place other than that little bandwidth, you're really at a loss. But Donald was this master teacher who could go up and down wherever the question came from. And so that was my second step of this change for me. Third step was another science committee trip with a stopover at the Great Barrier Reef and something of a spiritual awakening. Now, just put spiritual awakening with science committee trip. That seems incongruous, doesn't it? I mean, how can you have a spiritual awakening on a science committee trip? All scientists are godless, aren't they? Apparently not, because this Australian climate scientist was snorkeling with me and showing me the effects of coral bleaching. And by the way, I guess you might have heard that by 2050, we may lose 90% of Earth's corals, and 90% may be a little bit of a low estimate. They may all be gone by 2050. If you or your kids or grandkids want to see corals, get quickly to somewhere to see them, because they might be gone by 2050. So he was showing me the impacts of this. By the way, what that was going on there is there's a symbiotic relationship between the coral and an algae. You increase the temperature of the water by 1 degree C, and for some reason, the coral kicks the algae out of bed, and they both die. And so apparently it's too hot in bed, and the coral says, get out, and so they both die. And so that's happening at the Great Barrier Reef. So this Australian climate scientist was showing me this, and I could tell that he and I shared a worldview by the way he was interacting with nature. I could see that he was clearly not worshiping nature, but he was worshiping the God of creation. I could just see it. In his eyes, hear it in his voice. I knew we shared a worldview, because, you know, St. Francis of Assisi said, preach the gospel at all times. If necessary, use words. And so Scott wasn't using any words, but he was preaching the gospel. He's now become a very dear friend. And so later we had a chance to talk, and he told me about conservation changes that he's making in his life to love God and love people. People that we'll never know, they'll come after us. Scott does some things that some of my conservative constituents in that former district would think are sort of silly. He rides his bike to work. He tries to do without air conditioning in Townsville, Australia, as often as his wife and three daughters will let him. And he tries to do without the electric dryer, putting clothes on the line. And so I got right inspired. I wanted to be like Scott, loving God, loving people. So I came home to Congress and introduced the Raise Wages, Cut Carbon Act of 2009. That's a revenue-neutral, border-adjustable
carbon tax.
Pay no attention to those last two words, ladies and gentlemen. Let's focus on the first two compound adjectives. I'll come back to that in a minute. Revenue neutral, border adjustable. I'll come back to that in a minute. I want to complete. So I found out something about you. I'm telling you about me, and I'm going to tell you about that idea. And so that got me in a bit of political trouble, along with some other heresies. I voted for comprehensive immigration reform, although we never called it that. I'd voted for TARP, the Troubled Asset Relief Program. That's President Bush's rescue of the banks, as you recall, in the Great Recession. Let's see, let me confess all my sins. What else had I done wrong? I voted against the troop surge in Iraq because I had conservative concerns that my friend George W. Bush, and he is my friend, was doing nation building in Iraq. I knew the American military could do it. It's just I wanted the Iraqis to offer up their blood and treasure rather than American blood and treasure to secure the peace in Iraq. And so all those things got me in trouble, but the biggest thing that got me in trouble was just saying that climate change is real. Because it appeared that I'd crossed to the other side, that I was now marching with Al Gore and the Democrats. And you know, when a tribe is under pressure, and we were under pressure, all of us, in the Great Recession, when a tribe is under pressure, orthodoxy becomes important. You know, if there's plenty of food around, sure, bring your next door neighbor to the family gathering, that's fine. But if food gets short, no, only family in here, right? And the orthodoxy is tighter in tight times. And so the orthodoxy got quite tight in the Great Recession. And it appeared that I was an outsider to that orthodoxy. And so, as Bob indicated, it wasn't even close. And after 12 years in Congress, I got 29% of the vote in a Republican runoff. And the other guy got 71%. Which is a rather spectacular face plant. And so at that point, a foundation came to me and said, you know, Inglis, you're an unusual zoo animal, an actual conservative. By the way, it's 93 American Conservative Union lifetime rating, 100% Christian Coalition, 100% National Right to Life, A with the NRA, zero with the Americans for Democratic Action, that's a liberal group, and 23 by some mistake with the AFL-CIO, a labor union. I was really hoping for a zero. And so they said, an actual conservative who says climate change is real, will you speak and write for the proposition? And so I said, yeah, if the food's nice and the cage is good. So the food's been good here in Charlottesville, and Charlottesville is a beautiful cage. So I've basically been doing that ever since. And now what we've got is two people in D.C., one in Wisconsin, one in California, and two of us live and work from South Carolina. We've recruited about 5,000 people online at republicen.org, and I hope you'll join us there. To basically make visible a constituency on the right for action on climate change. Because as I said a while ago, the left has gone by as far as it can go. In order to make climate action durable, like every major piece of environmental legislation in this country has been, it needs to be bipartisan. Because this is a major societal endeavor. Worldwide endeavor to deal with climate change, so there has to be a bipartisan solution rather than a ram it through on one side solution. So I told you, I found out something about you, I told you about me, and now let me tell you a little bit about that idea, and then I'm going to open it up for your questions and comments. I said it was a revenue neutral, border adjustable carbon tax. And I hope you're going to help me find a better word than tax, all right? but some people suggest fee, some people say charge. We just go ahead and admit it's a tax, because I think my conservative friends would jump on me with both feet if I didn't admit it to be a tax. But the important thing to focus on is that the administrative simplicity and the amazing consensus in the field of economics about how to deal with climate change. You know, there's considerable consensus among the scientists about the causes and largely the effects of climate change. But there is almost unanimity in the economics profession about what to do about it. In fact, it's really hard to find an economist who would disagree with the notion of internalizing negative externalities. It's basically the concept that every product should bear all of its cost and present those costs in a transparent, accountable marketplace. I once asked a professor at Virginia Tech, a senior economist, to give me the name of an economist that might disagree with that, or somebody that I should read to know, be aware of. And he sat back in his chair and he thought and he said, there isn't one. And he said, you can't be an economist if you disagree with that concept. In fact, he said, it'd be like being a scientist and not believing in the scientific method. And so he said, it just doesn't exist. That's a category that doesn't exist. It's not a thing. So what economists would say to do, and this is, you know, Harry Truman said he wanted a one-arm economist, right? Well, this is not an on-the-one-hand, on-the-other-hand thing with economists. They almost all agree that what you do is you simply make all the products bear all their cost, show the cost to the marketplace. And so the way that we would see doing that for climate change is a carbon tax applied at the mine and at the pipeline. Now, the beauty of that is there are only 2,000 companies in the United States that either mine coal or put stuff in a pipeline. So it's a very small job for the IRS. They could do it in a room this size. And so administratively, it's quite simple. Now, of course, the bad news is the price of everything downstream goes up once you put that price on, right? I mean, the price of this electricity might go up, the price of the plastics in the room go up, the price of just about everything goes up. Not artificially, though. It goes to its more actual cost. the cost that shows its full cost rather than hiding those costs somewhere else. And so Bob heard me speaking to a group of students yesterday on grounds, and I gave this example. I'm endless coal-fired electricity. I burn coal, boil water, turn a generator, and send electrons down the line to your house. That's my business. I get away with socializing my soot, and it is a great deal for me. I scrub my stack a little bit, but a lot of my small particulates go on up in the air, trash dump at the sky. I don't pay anything for deposits there. Unlike when, if I were a trash hauler and I was taking dump trash to the Charlottesville City dump, I'd have to pay a tipping fee for the space I'm taking up, and then I'd back that charge up to my customers. Totally justified among conservatives, seems to me, and among progressives too, is like, of course that's what you want, because in the salad bar of life, take what you want, but pay for what you take. And so if you're taking up space in Charlottesville City dump, pay for it. And but Inglis coal-fired electricity doesn't pay for the space it's taking in the sky. I just get to dump my small particulates up there, and I get to cause climate damages by my CO2 emissions, and I'm not accountable. It is a great deal for me. Now, if you cause me to scrub my stack a little bit more, my cost will go up because I've got to buy a lot of capital equipment, right? And then I'm heard to complain to the local member of Congress, oh, no, you don't want to do that. You don't want this carbon tax thing, because if I scrub my stack better and if I'm accountable for those carbon emissions, then I'm going to charge your customers more for their power, and they're going to be powerfully mad at you, Congresswoman or Congressman. But someday a conservative is going to say back to me, Inglis, we're already paying the full cost of your supposedly cheap coal-fired electricity. We pay in the healthcare system for admissions to the hospital caused by those small particulates. We're paying in climate damages long-term. We're paying all right, we're just not paying at the meter. So what we think at RepublicEan.org, and frankly what most economists say, is go ahead and put it on Inglis. Make him accountable. Show that cost to the marketplace. And then what's going to happen? Well, what's going to happen is pretty immediately natural gas is going to beat me making coal-fired electricity, because it's a cleaner, better way to make electricity than coal. So I probably lose immediately to natural gas. And then I lose probably after that to wind and solar, in some places nuclear, particularly small modular nukes. So that's probably the progress of technology. But right now it's held back by this problem of economics. And so what we say is fix the economics and then watch the environment take care of itself. And Bob reminded me, he heard me say at a different time, and I didn't say it yesterday on grounds, is that means for us at RepublicEan.org, eliminate all the subsidies, all the current props for all the renewables that we have right now. So we take a pretty high-octane conservative position on this. We say no more electric car credits. My wife and I bought a Volt. We got $7,500 credit. Is that fair and right? We zip past some poor person driving a clunker on the road, getting 15 miles a gallon, maybe. Why'd we get a $7,500 credit? Shouldn't get a $7,500 credit. We should just eliminate just create a level playing field in the marketplace. Why should wind get a production tax credit, which is killing nuclear at this point? Why should solar have an investment tax credit? Because they're good boys and girls, and so the government puts its thumb on the scales and say, oh, good boy, good girl, you've got solar. We're going to give you some money. Why not eliminate all of those subsidies? And by the way, that kills wind immediately. Until this comes along, eliminate the biggest subsidy of them all. And this is what we at RepublicEan.org want to bring to Republican ears and conservative ears. Eliminate the biggest subsidy of them all, the granddaddy of all of them, which is me being able to dump into the trash dump of the sky without paying a tipping fee. That's bigger than all of those other ones. And so if you level that playing field, wind comes back to life. It says, we don't need the production tax credit. In fact, we'd rather do without it, because every time it expires, it's a lobbyist full employment act. You know what I mean? It's going to expire in 3 years. And boy, are they going to spend money on lobbying in Washington in order to extend that thing. So eliminate all of them. Doesn't that sound like, the one who mentioned libertarian thought over here, doesn't that sound really strong libertarian conservative thought? And actually, it's completely consistent with progressive thought, too. It's like, yeah, just level the playing field and watch the free enterprise system deliver innovation. So that's what we're excited about at RepublicEan.org. It's why we call ourselves energy optimist and climate realist. And let me stop here in just a minute and open your questions. But let me anticipate one of them, which is, okay, Inglis, we do this in America, but the rest of the world goes right on polluting. And you're right, that is a big problem. We got to figure a way to get China and India in on this deal. And the way to do that is to border adjust the tax. That means that we collect the tax on entry of goods from countries that don't have the same carbon tax. And so China is importing right now a sheet of flat steel through the port of Charleston, South Carolina. They stole the technology from us. They've manipulated their currency. They're selling that at a cheap price. And it's coming into America through the port of Charleston. So we say to them, we just collected the tax. The money is then going to Washington. China challenges in the World Trade Organization. They say, you can't do that. That's a tariff. We win that case based on precedents in the chemical industry. Say then you can tax based on the content of the stuff coming in. It's a content tax. So if we win, then China, check me to see if this makes sense to you. China, 24 hours later, has the same carbon tax internal to China. Why? Because they're just paid on entry through the port of Charleston a tax that ended up in Washington funding the U.S. government. If they just collected that tax in China, it would have gone to Beijing, and they would have been funding the Chinese government. So 24 hours later, they've got the same price on carbon dioxide. They're amazingly efficient, you know, in reaching a decision in China. So it really would take them only about 24 hours to do that. And so then the rest of the world follows. And then you got 7 billion people around the world demanding innovation. And just like the cell phone that may be in your pocket that came down in price, energy starts coming down in price. Storage comes down in price. Solar efficiencies go up. Because then you've got investors marrying inventors, and stuff is flying off the lab shelf and onto the shelf at stores and being installed in homes and businesses because the economics now work. And so we think it's an incredibly exciting opportunity to grow wealth and jobs in America if we play our cards right. If we miss the opportunity, we miss the opportunity of the century to reinvent the way that we do energy. And so the other part I should have mentioned is it's revenue neutral. This carbon tax becomes revenue neutral. If you cut taxes somewhere else in equal amount or dividend all the money back to people, so there's no growth of government. We'll go into that if you want to in the Q&A time. But let me stop and, having found out about you, told you about me, and told you about this idea, let me see what questions or comments you have.
Yes, sir. Thanks very much for an interesting presentation. There seems to be a critical element to the overall problem of environmental change that wasn't mentioned, and that was the time factor. As we all know, according to the best available evidence, the clock is ticking.
Yeah.
We only have, according to most experts, a certain amount of time to reverse the trend that we're on in order to stop it before we reach a critical mass and would be unable to turn it back.
Right.
Could you address that, please?
Yeah, it is essential that we move quickly, and we have wasted a lot of time. The longer you wait, the more expensive action becomes and the fewer options you have. And so it's a little bit like life itself. You know, if you eat right and exercise, you probably avoid the cardiologist later. Or you might avoid the cardiologist. You might still have the cardiologist in your life. But chances are you do better as to the cardiologist, right? And so it's just like that in climate change. And we are, the key is to avoid the heart attack at the end of all this, right? Because this, it is, time is of the essence and is not on our side. So agree completely. Now, some people would say, therefore, and this is a respectable position, you could say, therefore, we need to do what, say, Bill McKibben would say to do, which if he were here, Bill's a good guy who would say that, and really a very decent human being, he would say, listen, we go to 350 parts per million, we regulate down to that, and the government gets us down there by the regulations. That's a respectable position. It's just not our position at republican.org. We think that the fastest way to get there is actually through free enterprise innovation, rather than government regulations, incentives, and tax, and various kinds of mandates. But in order to believe that, what I believe about that, you have to believe in the power of free enterprise. And I realize not everybody shares my faith in free enterprise. But I would point out that free enterprise does deliver innovation faster than government. And we have a proof of that in the way that the Soviet Union collapsed. The Soviets had smart bureaucrats, I gotta believe, who came up with systems, and they implemented five-year plans, and they just got clunky, right? I mean, the stuff was clunky. And meanwhile, American innovators were profit-driven, and as long as you make it accountable profit-driven, I mean, bring all the cost and show them in the marketplace, then we believe that you get innovation very rapidly through the free enterprise system. And if you're a progressive and you say, why am I agreeing with this right-winger who's talking up there? Well, it's because maybe Al Gore has been for exactly what I've just talked about for about 30 years. And he's making money at Kleiner Perkins right now, the people who created Google or funded Google. And he's pursuing all kinds of projects like this. And, of course, we conservatives hate him because he's making money in free enterprise, because we don't believe in making money in free enterprise, you know. And so it's a terrible idea. He should not make money. We don't like it when people make money. Actually, I don't know why we hate him, but we hate him. But maybe we can overcome that and say, hey, listen, Al, if you can come up with that saltwater battery, that sodium battery, the size of a dishwasher that'll go in a basement of a house that you all are working on at Kleiner Perkins, and it collects sun off the roof, puts it in the storage in the basement, powers the car, powers the house, and then we say to the Middle East, see if you can drink that stuff, maybe a really better world. And so the people who created Google might be creating that dishwasher for you that goes in the basement. And if they can, and I got to believe that they're the ones that can do it faster. We had great people in government, great scientists, great people. But I got to believe that the private sector, where there's a profit motive to get there quickly, is going to commercialize that better. But let me make sure to tip my hat to anybody that might be involved in DARPA that created the internet and the PC. That was not private enterprise. That was the government that did that, the internet and the PC. And then a guy named Jobs and a guy named Gates started competing. One decided to tell you he'd offer you a low price. The other decided he'd offer you style. That was the Apple product. The other one said, I'll offer you price. And they competed, and they drove the prices down, trying to get to a mass market. And they did, and now a lot of us have the phones in the pocket. That's going to happen in energy if the free enterprise system does it. But it does involve a role for government, because the government has to say, all cost in, all subsidies out, I'll compete.
I agree with your premise, and I agree with your solution, but political reality seems that we aren't going to get there because there is so much opposition to the tax. As yeah. witness you getting defeated, as witness Washington State voting down a carbon tax, right. You know, pretty substantially in a fairly liberal state.
Right.
So how do we solve the political problem?
Yeah, great question. Well, we're working on it, Coach. It's a building year. Okay, so it's like this. I'd say it is. You've got two important data points there. One is my loss, and then the other is Washington State. But there's a difference between now and when I lost. When I lost is the darkest days of the Great Recession. So three differences. One is the economy is better now. Second, we've all had experiences with climate change and more of those experiences. And then third is now we have people on what we call the eco-right that exist as a balance to the environmental left. There are hundreds of millions of dollars spent on the environmental left in this country every year. Hundreds of millions of dollars. There's a paucity spent on the right. So we've got a condor wing over here on the left. We've got a hummingbird wing on the right. But we're trying to grow that wing. And so it has grown some. In 2009, when I introduced that bill, there was no RepublicEN.org. There was no Clear Path Foundation. There was no Climate Leadership Council. There was no R Street Institute, no Niskanen Center. I could go on with a number of eco-right organizations. None of them existed. And so the only thing that existed was Americans for Prosperity, which panned me, and Heritage Foundation, which produced a study within, I think, 48 hours, exhaustive study, they said, showing that my bill would single-handedly destroy American civilization. I don't know how they came up with it in 48 hours, but sure enough, an exhaustive study. And so that's what I faced. Now, contrast that with when Carlos Curbelo introduced a carbon tax in the last Congress. He lost in the general election, but he did not lose because of climate. He lost because it was a Democrat district and he was a Republican. But he introduced a carbon tax, and RepublicEN.org and all those other groups I just mentioned, plus a lot more, said, attaboy, Carlos. And of course, Heritage was still saying, terrible, Carlos. And Americans for Prosperity was still saying, terrible, Carlos. But there were some other people, other voices on the right. So there are three differences between my loss and now, and now it's safer. In the Washington State situation, you're right, that is another data point. And it is troublesome that there have been two initiatives in Washington State, 732 and this most recently is 1631. 732 was revenue neutral. It would have put on a carbon tax and then returned the money in corresponding tax cuts. And it was run by an economist named Yoram Bauman, and he's a good friend and a great guy. And the left didn't like it. And the Sierra Club panned it. And I think they learned a lesson from it, which was, oh my gosh, it was a great opportunity when we had the right saying, let's do it. Why can't the left say, we'll come back later and talk about environmental justice? Rather than trying to solve all of the problems of humanity in a single bill, take what you can get while the getting is good and get a price on carbon dioxide, come back later and figure out the terrible problems of environmental justice, which are real, which is that poor people have to live next to the dump. But can we come back to that after we deal with this urgent problem right here? That is a problem, the environmental justice thing, but let's come back to it. And then, when that failed, then they did 1631. And that one, it was not revenue neutral. Governor Inslee, who's running for president now on the Democratic side, says, here, we can put on this carbon tax, and then I will appoint a committee of notable people to figure out what to do with the money. Well, can't you see that that's immediately attackable? It's like, well, these are unelected people who are going to decide what to do with all that carbon tax revenue? No way. So it failed. So I agree with you. You've got two data points there, but I hope the trend line can bend differently because of some other intervening data.
Hi, I found your talk to be very interesting. particularly having a background in the topic, particularly over the years, I happen to have done my doctoral research at Savannah River Ecology Lab.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, well familiar with that part of
It's terrific.
The state of South Carolina. My question is, have you done any modeling as to what would be the correct touch points? You mentioned the steel coming in from China through Charleston, but other touch points that would allow us to force the issue with India and China and some of the other areas, not just picking one or two spots, if you follow what I'm trying to say. It will take more than just saying working on the steel.
Oh, sure, yeah.
To do the border.
Yeah, it'd be a very complicated job and very difficult, and it would last about 2 weeks. This is what's so strange about an agency would have to be set up. It's like mutual assured destruction. You have to have a credible deterrent. You have to have credible enforcement. And so it'd be like this. We'd have to have really difficult work done to figure out, say, an iPhone. What is the carbon footprint of all the components of that iPhone that's coming in through the Port of Charleston? Sheet of flat steel is easy. You're right. An iPhone, very difficult to figure out what its carbon content is. But the thing is, this agency, having been set up and coming up with enormous calculations about all that stuff, we think would live about 2 weeks. Because China, after they lost the WTO case, would be following. And then the whole world would. And the agency would just go kaput. Don't need it anymore. But you would have to, in order either that or get a signal from the Chinese that we're with you on this. And I have a preliminary signal on that. Not that I'm tight with the Chinese or anything, but, you know, it's like this. I was at the Milken Institute a while back, and there was this Chinese professor from Brookings Institution on the panel. And Andy Revkin of New York Times was moderating. He asked me to describe what I've described to you here, this solution. And then he went to the other side with the Chinese professor who was sitting with Ms. Regas from Environmental Defense Fund and started to ask them a question. And the Chinese professor said, Andy, I'll get back to that, what you're asking. But what I want to say is I really prefer Bob Inglis's solution over there. It's the right answer. I hope he's a highly placed Chinese spy. I hope he's actually very close to President Xi, and that reflects the Chinese dictator's thinking, is that just give us a clear price signal, show us what it is, and we'll deal with it. And so it might be you don't have to set up this agency. It might be you can avoid that. But it also could be that just like all the nukes we've ever built, you hope never to use them. We might have to set up that agency and do all that incredibly sophisticated work to figure out the carbon footprint of an iPhone and every other kind of product coming into Walmart shelves.
You've spoken most of your talk about internalizing hidden costs. Mm-hmm. And then a couple minutes ago, you kind of, on the backside, mentioned eliminate subsidies. Now, aren't there subsidies that coal and other industries are receiving that wind, solar, et cetera, are not receiving?
Yes. Yeah.
We would eliminate the subsidy side.
Yeah, we would want to eliminate all of those. And here's what I find. If I'm speaking, some of our messaging is sort of across the Tea Party fence. You know, the Tea Party tossed me out of office, but it's basically we're out to message to them. We basically say across the fence, no more electric car credits. Right, they say. And then we say, no more production tax credit for wind. Right. And then no more investment tax credit for solar. Right. And then we get a little bit harder territory. No more undermarket leases on public land for the extraction of minerals. Right. And then we get to the hardest one, which is no more the biggest subsidy. As I said, the biggest subsidy of them all is me at Inglis Coal Fire Electricity being able to dump in the trash dump of the sky. And that from across the fence is coming back crickets right now, right? I mean, that's what we've got to change, is help people to see. That's a huge subsidy. It's the biggest one there is. And so make me accountable. And that's why I was asking at the beginning about what is conservatism. To me, what conservatism, one element of conservatism is accountability. That conservatives deeply believe, and many progressives do too, that accountability brings blessings. The lack of accountability wreaks havoc. Climate change is that havoc. And as I said about the salad bar of life, you know, in salad bar of life, take what you want, but pay for what you take. If you do, the restaurant can offer a nice salad bar. If you don't pay by weight, all they can offer is iceberg lettuce and Thousand Island dressing, right? But if you pay for what you take, they can have a turkey slicing station and nice mushrooms and stuff on the salad bar, right? Nice cheese, because you're paying for what you take. So that's what it is in energy. Pay for what you take. Enjoy as much as you want. And this is where we're a little bit different than the left messaging. You know, and this is what maybe, I hope you're hearing this, is what I'm talking is energy abundance, doing not with less, but more energy. Not with less mobility, more mobility. Just lit up on your roof, stored in your basement, running your car. People making those things here and selling them around the world, making money doing that. That's our vision of how this thing goes. Too often what people on my side of the aisle hear about climate change, oh, we got to walk and eat bugs. We got to do with less. We got to repent. We got to sweat or shiver in the dark, depending on the season. That's just not attractive. And so what we're saying is, no, this can be more energy. Figure out how to do it better. Did the car make life better than traveling by a horse? It did, but it has negative externalities associated with it. So now we clean those up, and I got to tell you, I'm driving a rental car right now. It's a Chevy Malibu or something. It's the body style of my Volt, the $7,500 credit that I got. My Volt is a lot nicer than this stinky car I've got. This stinky car cranks up and goes... my Volt, you put it on the gas and it doesn't make any sound. And if you're in one of those clunkers that has gasoline in it and you're at a stoplight with me, I can guarantee you I'll beat you off that light. Because that car will move, because electric cars go very fast. Now, of course, the question is duration of that move. But those batteries are getting better, just like the cell phone battery got better. And so, pretty exciting.
Tom. Hi, thanks. I can see where a carbon tax would be pretty good at controlling carbon use in new manufacturing and containing new emissions into the atmosphere. But the Intergovernmental Panel report that scared all of us last year says that we also need unprecedented efforts to draw down greenhouse gases, CO2, that already are in the atmosphere. And
yeah.
Some of this can be done with things like restoring forests and so on, but some of it seems to be one or another man-made geoengineering or some kind of engineering system that probably takes energy to chemically capture carbon out of the atmosphere and maybe stores it deep in geological faults. So there's no taxable product in a lot of this. And so this side of us seems less amenable to control or are dealing with from a carbon tax. And that's, I've seen people like the Green New Deal calling for, you know, modern monetary theory, printing lots of money, saying that government debt doesn't really mean much anymore. Have you got any comments about how to fund the efforts that seem to be needed soon that don't produce taxable products?
Yeah, glad you asked. Yeah, we think that the carbon tax I've been describing would improve the economics of those, but it wouldn't get you all the way there. And so it does require government expenditures on basic research on carbon capture and sequestration. And the most exciting of that is that a direct air capture, where you actually are running some kind of a process to suck CO2 out of the air and get it sequestered. A carbon tax would improve the economics a little bit for that, making it so that it makes a little more sense to try to do it. But it doesn't get you all the way there, as I said. So direct expenditures are needed on that. And interestingly enough, I think that there are many conservatives in Congress right now that are open to that. Because if you represent Montana, let's say, or West Virginia, if you think there's some way that maybe we could burn all that coal and suck the CO2 out of the air, then there's sort of end to that. I will tell you, based on what I know from Science Committee, which is basically being wowed by the science, it may be possible. It's pretty expensive energy challenge. In other words, you got to spend a lot of energy in order to suck it down. The geoengineering that you mentioned, less enamored with, I will tell you, about the basically taking artillery shells and blasting mirrors into the stratosphere or somewhere. That seems to me a little bit like sitting in a petri dish and doing an experiment on yourself. You know, I mean, it's like maybe you want to do it in a petri dish that you're not sitting in, but we don't have an alternative earth that we can experiment with. So we're literally in the dish doing it. But to the earlier question, if we wait too long, that's the kind of thing you have to just try, right? I mean, so, but if you act sooner, you don't have to be blasting particles into space and hoping for the best.
How do you get past, as a lifelong Republican, the willful ignorance on the part of many of your party mates, and I'm using as Exhibit 1 that bozo senator who stood on the White House, the Capitol steps with a snowball in his hand, who didn't understand the difference between climate and weather,
yeah,
and made the comment about global warming.
Yeah. So some of it has become, you know, for a while it was maybe conscious disregard. No, it's sort of unconscious disregard. No, it was somewhere between culpable and not culpable. In other words, it was sort of like, it's like we were somewhat aware of the risk and ignoring it. But now it's gotten to the place where it is conscious disregard. And that's, I think, the definition of recklessness, isn't it? I mean, it's like if you're consciously disregarding something, then you're actually acting recklessly. It is a challenge. And I'd tell you that's our role. Our job at RepublicIan.org is to create a space on this right-hand wall that allows a member of Congress or a senator to come off of that wall and toward solutions. That doesn't mean acquiescing to the other side or abandoning principle. It means that you're so solid in your principles that you can figure out how to deal with other people in Solutionville out here somewhere in the middle, because you're firmly tethered over there. It's people that are uncertain of themselves that have to slam themselves for security on that wall. And by the way, the same thing happens over here on this wall. Jerry Nadler, who's the chairman of the Judiciary Committee, I knew in my Congress days, and Jerry told me one time it's exhausting to represent his district. He said it's one of the most liberal districts in the country. He says, I got to wake up every morning and figure out how to out-liberal my people. He says it's exhausting. And so Jerry's over there on his left-hand wall. Why? Because if you create a little bit of space between yourself and that wall, there'll be some left-winger who runs against you in a primary and beats you. Ask Crowley and AOC what happened there. I mean, in other words, and same thing happens on the right. And so the senator you just mentioned, actually, he's a special case. I think he actually believes what he's saying, right? And so, but there are a number that are on that wall, not because they believe it. They have kids that are going to UVA or Virginia Tech. They're coming home and they're saying, Mom, what you said on the Senate floor, Dad, what you said on the House floor, you realize it's not what you're paying for at State U. At State U, they're teaching me the opposite of what you're saying. And so that kid's coming home for Passover, coming home for Easter, and there is dissonance over there on that wall. And so what we live to do is get in between the wall and that member that wants to come off of the wall and fill that space. And that's what you can help us do, by the way, by joining us at republicen.org, because by being visible, especially, I would say to you, seniors visible, because if you go look at our website, you'll see a lot of young people pictures. And what the average politician knows is they're wonderful, they got energy and enthusiasm, they don't vote. Their participation in the last election got to 30%, up from 16%, which is a great improvement, but it's still just 30%. So they see people with this color hair, and they say, that's a high propensity voter. That really plugs space on the right-hand wall, because they say, by golly, that's a senior, they're going to vote. And they're saying climate change is real, and they are identifying as wanting a conservative to come into this solution. That's powerful. You become very powerful over there. So join us, if you would, at republicen.org. Take about a minute.
All right. I don't know whether you've ever been to India, but when you go to many other countries, and you know, there's more people in India that are burning dung and putting smoke in the air, you have the opportunity to not do it. You know, you have that choice.
Yeah.
They simply don't. And
right.
So that change is not going to occur readily. So we have to do much more than what one would think to be directly our share. Trying to apportion all every product, what is its carbon footprint? You're going to have everybody, the lobbyists and the lawyers on this. Why, that's going to be a huge headache. And it's only going to solve the problem in the well-developed world. It isn't going to help elsewhere.
That's you're right, except how about this? If we develop distributed energy systems here and get the price down, what I'm talking about distributed energy systems is probably small-scale solar stored in better batteries. So better efficiency, I'm assuming better efficiency in the solar, so you have smaller arrays, and better efficiency in the battery, so it's longer duration. If, and that's there are two ifs there, if that happens and you can sell those systems around the world, you serve those customers in those dark places, in those little villages in India. And the example, the corresponding example would be cell phone technology, again, in Africa, for example. The idea at first was, oh my goodness, the Africans are so far behind us on telecommuting, or telecommunicating, that they're going to have to build all these, put in these fiber optic lines, and it's going to be enormously expensive, and the continent is so huge, and No, they leapfrogged us. They didn't do that. They went straight to cell phone technology. And so that's what's going to happen in India, is that they don't, in concentrated areas, you will need a central power plant. But because there's no way in, say, Mumbai is the only place in India that I've been, and there's no way in the slums of Mumbai that you can get enough solar to power that many people's lives. But in the countryside, these distributed energy systems could make a huge difference, probably in those high concentration places, just like here. It's going to take, and I've get this where you get nervous because you start losing the progressives in the crowd or some people that have listened a little bit too much to the spending on the environmental left, is probably modular nukes are the way to handle New York City and Mumbai. Small nuclear machines or reactors that are like on nuclear submarines that can power part of Manhattan. And the key to them, as we've learned in South Carolina, by a $9 billion mistake that we've got a hole in the ground in South Carolina with a power plant that has just been canceled, an enormous light water reactor that isn't going, is stopped. I mean, the project has been stopped. Is it better to produce small nukes on an assembly line and run them off at very predictable cost and then drop it in a hole in Mumbai neighborhood, and you've lightened the place up. Right, you do get not in my backyard, and you get the nuclear waste problem. And here's where, let me just point out, let me just admit to not being pure, okay? Where everybody, we should all confess our sins, as I was earlier, and let me confess it, I'm not pure. I'm talking about eliminating subsidies. But if you're going to have emissionless nuclear power, you have to have a subsidy, which is the public has to take the nuclear waste and dispose of it. Take it away from the company, because the company cannot afford to do that. Because you cannot, in a private enterprise, find a loan officer that will give you a term loan where the term is 800,000 years, because he or she is not likely to be around, and you're not likely to be around. And so government has to take the waste. And it's a trade-off. It's a fallen world, and I accept the fact that I'm not pure, and I will deal with that waste by having a public subsidy there. But as much as possible, remove those implicit subsidies and watch the free enterprise system deliver, but probably won't deliver in those concentrated places without something like nuclear power. And by the way, if that sounds not just conservative, but sounds familiar to you as a progressive, it's because people like Jim Hansen are begging the nation to build nuclear power plants and build them quickly. This is Jim Hansen, the famous guy of climate change that the left generally loves, and Bill Gates saying, build them and build them fast. So it's the kind of thing, if you come off that left wall, if you come off this right wall, you can figure it out. We can do these things and achieve the objective.
I've always been curious regarding the carbon tax about how to set the tax. What amount? I have heard numbers like $45 U.S. per ton of CO. I think that's one of the numbers I've heard. How do you pick that? It seems to me there's no logical way to price the destruction of the Earth 100 years from now. I don't know how to do that. I don't think you will know either.
Yeah.
So I'm curious how you pick a price for the externality. I can see that you could look at the effects of it, and if it doesn't switch the market fast enough, raise the tax. That's the only rule I can think of.
Yeah, and I'll take that rule. That works fine. In other words, that's what you got to do. There's no holy writ that's going to come down to tell us what the optimal price on carbon dioxide is. It's just like their current tax code. Why do we have the rates we've got? Well, the give and take of the political process in a constitutional republic where we elect representatives and they go decide how much to tax us. And so right now we've got the carbon price set at zero, that endless coal-fired electricity causes no harm. And as long as you believe that, that's great for me at endless coal-fired electricity. It's a great day for me. But it's when you just as society decide to say to me, endless, no. It's not zero. It's way north of zero, that your cost you're putting on us. So now, man up, Inglis, and be responsible for those costs. And so my bill started at $15 a ton, rising to $100 a ton over 30 years' time. A number of bills start at $25 a ton. Some start at $40 a ton. Here's a rule of thumb. A $25 per ton price on carbon dioxide causes the price of gasoline to go up by 25 cents a gallon. A $40 per ton causes it to go up 40 cents per gallon. It's almost directly proportional there. And so it causes the price of electricity. $25 a ton of CO2 causes the price of electricity to go up by 1 to 2 cents per kilowatt hour. It's $11 for the average home in America. Now, not everybody has an average home, right? But it's $11 a month. That's $11 a month, and that's money. But I hope what you're hearing there is it's not catastrophic, and that. But it's the change at the margin that causes people to change behavior, and so. But the key is the carbon tax is set, and then that it steadily increases. That's the key for the behavior change: is that it's steadily increasing. The worst case scenario is to get a low carbon price that doesn't move. because that's basically guaranteeing that we've got climate problems ahead. But if you start it and then just get it going up, as long as you're returning the revenue to people in the form of a dividend or cutting their taxes somewhere else, there's no growth of government. And as long as you're applying it to imports in the same way, you're getting India and China in, then what's there not to like about it, right? We do adjust because our energy bills go up, but our paycheck got bigger, or a prospective increase in Social Security is the way that I was going to do it. For retired people that aren't paying the payroll tax, they paid through their lives payroll tax, now they're receiving Social Security, you got to increase the Social Security check to offset that energy inflation. So there are ways of dealing with this such that you're not causing people hardship, but you are causing them to think, do I really want the cantaloupe on the salad bar? My wife and I have 5 kids. You watch the Inglises at a salad bar, all those kids know exactly what to do. You pile the plate with spinach. Because you know why? Spinach doesn't weigh anything. You definitely pass up the cantaloupe. Cantaloupe is all water, and at 8.3 pounds per gallon, you don't want cantaloupe. You can get cantaloupe later. English kids know how to do this. And so, if the energy prices relatively go up, but you've got money in your pocket, well, then make your own decision. Do you really want to be at 78 degrees in the winter in your house?
I'm a professor emeritus of mechanical and aerospace engineering. I'd like to talk about the small nuclear power plants. A number of years ago, Exelon came to me, and also the director of GE Gas Turbines sent us to South Africa to do analysis on the pebble bed modular reactor, a design from Germany. It was a marvelous design, small power plant circulating helium. We spent 3 weeks analyzing the system. We also had a nuclear engineer there. The nuclear design was wonderful. We said the mechanical design was terrible. And GE ended up buying that company. They're going broke. We said, if we had a proper design of the turbines, this is a wonderful small nuclear design because it doesn't melt down. Pebble bed modular reactor circulates helium, but it needs better turbines and generators there. So Exelon did not desire to spend $1 billion on it. But it's going to Japan. They are working on it. So this is an area that needs massive government work. There's a lot of nuclear designs out there. As a professor of engineering, we look at what is the basic problem. The basic problem is electricity use is going up. Carbon dioxide is going up. We have to cut down the carbon dioxide. There's a fourfold approach to this. Number one, wind power and solar requires good batteries to store it, but it's only going to do 15% to 20%. We need also with our power plants, I've worked with a lot of power plants, and every manager said if the government would subsidize, we need scrubbers because we're not going to get rid of the power plants. But the problem is the largest amount of mercury in the atmosphere is caused by cold. We need scrubbers to do that.
We're going to have a running out of time. Is there a question here?
Yes, we need to have a Manhattan Project for good small nuclear power plants. It's the only way we're going to solve the energy prices. We have to go nuclear. There are some safe designs.
That's great. And the good news is many Republicans agree, so that could be done in Congress.
This isn't a question, so it won't take very long, but I think there's a huge factor that affects our atmosphere and many other problems that we're having for the Earth. And that is the increasing population, human population of the Earth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. If you increase prosperity, though, you have that cut back.
Well.
That's the interesting thing about population growth is I was about to make a joke, but it is also true, is once they get televisions, they have other ways to entertain themselves. it's also true that if your children are going to live, you don't have as many. It's when you feel very insecure, and that's what we found around the world, is prosperity actually causes people to have smaller families. I know, I got 5. I'm guilty.
Yeah,
that's No, that's right. But thank you very much. Y'all are nice to have me.
Thank you.